From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, some of the challenges that lie ahead in rebuilding Iraq and trying to create a democracy. We talk with Bathsheba Crocker, co-director of the Post-Conflict Reconstruction Project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Also, we remember Cecile Dobrunov, who died Monday at the age of 99. The bedtime story she made up and told her sons in 1930 became the basis for the Babar the Elephant stories. We'll listen back to an interview with her son, Laurent Dobrunov, who wrote and illustrated more than 40 Babar books. And music critic Milo Miles considers two soul singers, a newcomer named Donnie and veteran Betty Levette. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. U.S. troops swept through Baghdad today, where the Iraqi regime has apparently collapsed. In many neighborhoods, they were greeted by cheering crowds who were tearing down symbols of Saddam Hussein's regime. U.S. Marines helped pull down a giant statue of Saddam, and Iraqis dragged parts of it through the streets. Despite the atmosphere of jubilation, though, NPR's Anne Garrell says parts of the city are still dangerous for U.S. troops.
I still hear the sounds of fighting in the distance. It's not intense, but every now and again I hear something. So I did not see, but I heard that from other reporters that they saw fedayeen and armed irregulars of Saddam's, and that they were still in evidence. But certainly in the part of town where I am, there's nothing. There are no guns in evidence.
NPR's Anne Garrell's in Baghdad. The collapse of civil authority in the capital led to widespread looting today. NPR's John Burnett is with the 1st Marine Division and flew over the Iraqi capital today in a Marine helicopter.
I saw lots of looting today. From the helicopter, you could see people sprawling all over the streets with wheelbarrows and carts and pickup trucks, and just particularly carting out office furniture and ceiling fans and carpets and drapes and sinks they've removed from bathrooms, and just everything imaginable.
NPR's John Burnett with the 1st Marine Division. So far, Allied commanders say they have no firm information about the whereabouts of Saddam Hussein. There have been unconfirmed rumors that the Iraqi leader and one of his sons were wounded and that one son was killed in a U.S. airstrike on a Baghdad neighborhood on Monday. U.S. forces say they still haven't been able to examine the site of that bombing. The apparent downfall of Saddam Hussein's government in Baghdad has sparked celebrations among Iraqis in the United States. Michael Leland reports from Michigan Public Radio in Dearborn, Michigan.
Just moments after television broadcasts showed Saddam Hussein's statue toppling in Baghdad, hundreds of Iraqis in Dearborn took to the streets in celebration. One group broke apart a portrait of Saddam. A man beat one fragment with a shoe, while several women stomped on another piece. Ismail Alsri says he cried while watching the news from Baghdad.
I thank you, God. Thank you, God. And thanks, Bush. Thanks, Blair, to make this good job. Believe me, good job, good job. You move Saddam Hussein.
Alsri says he has lived in the United States for about 8 years. He says his father died in 1994, and he wishes his father could have lived to see this day. For NPR News, I'm Michael Leland in Dearborn, Michigan.
In stocks, the Dow lost 101 points to close at 8,197. The Nasdaq lost 26. This is NPR News. Cuba has confirmed the convictions of dozens of human rights activists and independent journalists on charges of subversion. NPR's Jerry Haddon reports from Mexico City.
In the largest crackdown on dissidents in decades, 78 people have been facing trial since last week. The Cuban government has issued its first statement since the proceedings began, labeling the accused mercenaries of the United States. So far, sentences range from 6 to 28 years. President Fidel Castro's administration maintains U.S. diplomats in Havana are bankrolling subversive activities, plotting with the activists who undermine the regime and its economy. Chief diplomat James Kaysen has met with dissidents on several occasions, including in his residence, as part of the Bush administration's policy of promoting a rapid transition to democracy on the island. International human rights groups have condemned Cuba's one-day trials of the dissidents, saying the accused lack a proper defense. The proceedings have been closed to foreign journalists. Jerry Haddon, NPR News, Mexico City.
The UN Security Council discussed North Korea's refusal to abide by nuclear non-proliferation agreements, but failed today to agree on a statement condemning the communist nation's actions. After the closed-door meeting, diplomats said that China and Russia refused to support such a statement. Nevertheless, U.S. Ambassador John Negroponte said he was satisfied with today's talks and said he wouldn't rule out a condemnation from the Council in the future. Negroponte stressed that the U.S. wants a peaceful, multilateral solution to the problem. North Korea has said the solution could be reached only through face-to-face talks with the U.S., leading to a new non-aggression pact between the two countries. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Ace Group, Global Insurance and Reinsurance, Protection. It's not the end, it's the beginning. Continue. On the web at acelimited.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Many experts have warned that winning the war in Iraq may be a lot easier than winning the peace. My guest Bathsheba Crocker co-directs the Post-Conflict Reconstruction Project for the Center for Strategic and International Studies. She's one of the authors of their report, A Wiser Peace, which proposes a strategy for post-conflict Iraq. The report is a collaboration between the Center and the Association of the United States Army. One of the questions surrounding post-war Iraq is what role the UN will play. Yesterday, President Bush, speaking at a press conference with British Prime Minister Tony Blair, said that the UN would play a vital role in post-war Iraq. When asked to elaborate, he said, that means food, medicine, and aid. I asked Bathsheba Crocker about her understanding of the role the Bush administration wants the UN to have in post-war Iraq.
I think the only thing we know for certain is that the United States wants the UN to have a role on the humanitarian front. Anything beyond that is a little open to question. They have certainly said the UN has an important role to play, that they should play some sort of an advisory role, that they have a role to play in endorsing an interim authority. President Bush, when questioned about that, went so far as to say that the UN might be asked to suggest people to make up an Iraqi interim authority, but does not seem to be going as far as some might like to say that the United Nations should actually be in charge of running some sort of a conference to choose an Iraqi interim authority.
What's behind the division between the United States that wants to limit the role of the United Nations and some of the other countries, like France, for instance, which would like to see the UN play a larger role in the future of Iraq? What are those different points of view? What's behind that difference?
Well, I think from the U.S. side, there's probably some bad feelings left over from the fight at the UN leading up to the war itself, and a great deal of reluctance to have to go back to the UN Security Council and request authorization for post-war activities. I think there's a real sense that doing so will slow down the post-war efforts, which I think is a legitimate concern. I think also there is a big concern that because of interests by particularly the French and the Russians in terms of oil and their outstanding oil contracts, that turning questions such as what happens to the future of Iraqi oil over to the United Nations might get quite complicated. The Bush administration is now saying that decisions about Iraqi oil should be made by Iraqis, which is, of course, a laudable goal and something that I would agree with. But the question is, before we get to that point, should it be the UN or the U.S. overseeing the oil industry? From the side of others such as the French and the Germans and the Russians, I think in large part this is a question of whether the UN will provide needed legitimacy that will help them as a political matter in their own countries. Because their populations are so anti this war effort, and the governments obviously were too, I think there is a real feeling that they need the international stamp of legitimacy that UN involvement would bring. And of course, without taking these things to the UN, the French and the Germans and the Russians and others will not have much of a say about what happens in the post-war phase in Iraq, and I think that's obviously a large concern for them as well.
It's not only other countries that are conflicted with the United States over what the role of the UN should be in the future of Iraq. There seems to be a division within the Bush administration about that, the State Department versus the Pentagon. What are those divisions about regarding the UN?
Well, I think from the point of view of the State Department, there is an acknowledgement that if we take the discussions of the post-war phase to the UN, we will be able to make a bit of headway in mending our relations with our friends and allies and in mending our relations with others on the UN Security Council. And I think also from the State Department side, there is a concern that if we don't go that route, that the Defense Department will have a very big say in how things play out in Iraq over the next few months, including perhaps in choosing members of the Iraqi interim authority. And there is actually a great deal of division among various Bush administration officials over the question of, for example, the legitimacy of Ahmad Chalabi, who is the leader of the Iraqi National Congress, who has some friends in the Defense Department and is not so well liked in the State Department.
Jay Garner has been appointed by the Pentagon to head the Pentagon's Office of Reconstruction and Humanitarian Assistance in Iraq. He's a retired Army Lieutenant General, and he will report to General Tommy Franks, the commander of CENTCOM. What is the role that's expected he will play in Iraq?
Well, interestingly, it hasn't been described all that much in detail. He has canceled numerous scheduled appearances before the press, including most recently on Monday. So we haven't had much of an opportunity to hear described what his role will be. But in general, what they've said is that he will be coordinating reconstruction and humanitarian assistance, and that his office will play a big role in vetting Iraqi officials, so in vetting government ministries and institutions in Iraq to rid them of the most extreme Saddam loyalists. They have said that General Garner's office will be in the country not for a very long period of time. And in fact, again, on Tuesday, it was reported that he might perhaps only be there for about 90 days, after which period things would be turned over to the Iraqi interim authority.
Jay Garner will be reporting to General Tommy Franks, the commander of CENTCOM. So he's reporting to the military. What's the significance of that, that he's a Pentagon appointee, not a State Department one, and he's reporting to the military?
Well, I think some people see it as being quite significant, and I think it doesn't help if one goal here is to avoid the appearance of a military occupation. Again, things are a little fuzzy on this matter, because although there have been reports that General Garner will report to Tommy Franks, early press reports this week have suggested that perhaps Franks will be in charge for some period of time, and then things will be turned over to a civil administration that will be made up of General Garner's team and the Iraqi interim authority. So it may now be anticipated that after a certain period of time when things are stabilized, he will no longer report through Tommy Franks. But for now, one has to assume that he continues to do that. And although he is a retired Army general, the fact that he has some past affiliation with the military obviously sort of lends a further appearance that this is a Pentagon-driven effort and looks more like a U.S. military occupation. And I think that is quite troubling. If one of our goals here is to avoid that appearance, which I think it should be.
Well, what are your other concerns about avoiding the look or the reality of this being a military occupation in Iraq?
Well, I think there is a great deal of concern about how that will be received, not only by Iraqis within the country, which is perhaps the most important consideration here, but throughout the region and in the rest of the world. I do not think that the Europeans are going to look very favorably upon an extended U.S., what looks like an extended U.S. military occupation. It might cause problems for the U.N. as well. And in fact, various U.N. officials have said this week that it will be very difficult for them to go in and play any considerable role if what they're really doing is assisting a U.S. military occupation. But stepping back for a moment to address the question of the Iraqis again, as we've seen so far in the war effort, the reception to the coalition forces has been mixed. In some places, we have seen quite a warm welcome, but in most places, we actually haven't. I think that the resistance to the effort so far is more than we anticipated and should probably be taken as a sign that an extended military occupation or even a short-time military occupation by the U.S. will be met at least with pockets of resistance, if not with a high level of resistance by the Iraqi people.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Bathsheba Crocker. She is with the Center for Strategic and International Studies, where she's part of the Post-Conflict Reconstruction Project, and she's co-authored several papers about post-war Iraq. One of the big questions now is who is going to lead Iraq? What are the plans already in place to decide who will lead or how the leader will be chosen?
Well, the Bush administration has not said a lot about what the plans are, and I think part of the reason for that is the ongoing disputes both between the State Department and the Defense Department, but also that we haven't really come to terms with what we want the UN's role to be, and we need to have further discussions both with Tony Blair and with the other Europeans about what the UN, and then with the UN itself about what the UN's role should be. So we have seen already this week Ahmad Chalabi, who is the leader of the Iraqi National Congress, flown into southern Iraq. So he is now on the ground. Another major Iraqi opposition figure who is sitting in Iran at the moment has said that he will come in at some point this week. But although there have been vague reports about a possible conference to choose leaders of a future government, or choose leaders of an interim Iraqi government, rather, the details of any such conference have not been specified, and we don't yet know whether there even will be a conference or whether what we'll instead see is the U.S. coming up, working perhaps with Iraqis coming up with a list of Iraqi exiles and opposition figures and people from within the country to make up an Iraqi interim authority. I think there is an expectation that the Iraqi interim authority will rule together with the U.S. civil administrators for some period of time. And during that period of time, we will see mechanisms put in place for holding elections and that a permanent future Iraqi government will be a democratically elected one.
Who is the second leader who you mentioned, the one now in Iran?
I'm forgetting his first name. His last name is al-Hakim, and he is the leader of the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq. That is actually the largest Iraqi opposition group. It is made up of Iraqi Shiites, and he is currently in Iran, but has said that because Chalabi is now in the country, that he will go in sometime this week. There have, of course, been longstanding differences and disputes among the various Iraqi opposition parties, and that is one of the reasons that we have not seen any formal declaration of which opposition leader may rule in Iraq. May lead an Iraqi interim authority, and they were never, although they issued some joint statements, the Iraqi opposition various groups issued some joint statements leading up to the war effort, they were never able to sort of hammer out their own differences. And so an interesting thing that we may see as they start to move into the country is competing claims for authority, whether over various cities in the south or various government ministries.
Does the leader of the Islamic Revolutionary Group have any connections to the Bush administration?
Not that I know of, or at least not as close as Chalabi's relations are with the Bush administration. He, in fact, although he has come out and said he is supportive of the U.S.-led efforts to overthrow Saddam and therefore welcomes the U.S. troops in the country now, that he would not welcome a long-term U.S. military presence in the country or a long-term U.S. occupation of the country, or so-called occupation anyway. And again, I think this raises an interesting issue. Once he comes into the country, he apparently has 10,000 troops or militia members under his command. He has not indicated that he plans to fight against the American forces or the coalition forces, but it does get back to something we were discussing earlier about the likelihood of Iraqi resistance. And I think the longer we see a government, or even an interim government, in the country that is not accepted by Iraqis, the more we have to worry about various groups or factions, whether of opposition groups or former Republican Guard units, really creating problems for the U.S. or the coalition presence on the ground in the post-war time.
So the leader of the Islamic Revolutionary Group has thousands of troops. What about Chalabi? Does he have supporters?
He does have supporters, and he has gone into the country with about 700 other opposition members. He does not, as far as I know, have troops under his command. He is not a military leader. He has gone in, interestingly, in a sort of military capacity, because the Bush administration has spoken of these 700 opposition members as possibly being the beginnings of an Iraqi free army, but have also said that they will be carrying out other duties in the south of Iraq immediately, such as translation duties, helping to maybe smooth out some of the disputes that have that we have seen in some of the cities like Basra, and to help dole out humanitarian assistance.
Now, the leader of the Islamic Revolutionary Group, isn't that in a way exactly what the Bush administration doesn't want, an Islamic revolutionary leader heading up Iraq?
Well, the Bush administration has not come out explicitly and said that. I think there is obviously some concern when you really are talking about creating a democracy in Iraq that what could be elected in the future is a government that may not be exactly to your liking. But that is obviously one of the risks of setting up a true democracy in Iraq. It also gets back to the question of how much the U.S. wants to be involved in picking and choosing leaders, even of an Iraqi interim authority, because it starts to look less and less like democracy if you are calling the shots on who leads the country. That, again, is a reason I think it would be useful to have the UN running the process of choosing an Iraqi interim authority, because I don't think it's a good position for the United States to be in. Of course, the Shiites are the majority population in Iraq, so I think there is a real possibility that if you have democratic elections, you will see Shiites getting elected to the government. Having said that, Iraq is a secular country. There is not a huge history of fundamentalism in that country, and although the Shiites are somewhat allied with people in Iran, it's interesting to remember that in the Iran-Iraq War, the Shiites of Iraq actually fought very staunchly on the side of Saddam Hussein. So I think all of this is just goes to show that we're not exactly sure what would happen if the Shiites of Iraq got elected, but it is certainly a risk that we run by opening this country up to democracy.
My guest is Bathsheba Crocker. She co-directs the Post-Conflict Reconstruction Project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Bathsheba Crocker. She co-directs the Post-Conflict Reconstruction Project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
So we've talked a little bit about the head of the Islamic Revolutionary Group. Let's talk a little bit about Ahmed Chalabi, the Iraqi exile who has worked closely with the Pentagon. Who is he and why is he so controversial?
He is somebody who left Iraq in about over 40 years ago now. He is a banker in London. He also keeps a house in Washington. He is American educated. He went, I believe, to MIT and the University of Chicago. And he has been indicted for fraud in Jordan, but I don't know exactly on what the charges. He has made a lot of friends in Washington over the year. He has been a staunch proponent of overthrowing Saddam Hussein, and has done a very good job of making friends with both current members of the Bush administration, but also people on the Hill. He has numerous meetings on the Hill. He is here all the time lobbying on behalf of his cause. He says that he believes in a democratic future for Iraq, and in fact, at times has said that all he wants to see is the overthrow of Saddam and a stable government put into Iraq, and then he will step out of politics. His supporters cite those statements on his behalf. His opponents tend to be in the State Department and the CIA. I think that that people in the State Department and the CIA and parts of the White House are very concerned about Chalabi, both because he is seen as being somebody who just has sort of sat on the outside for a long time and has made a lot of money, so he is often criticized for sort of walking around in fancy expensive suits and expensive Rolex watches. I don't think that's the most legitimate criticism. I think there is a great concern that he will not have any legitimacy inside the country, and there's real concern in the halls of the State Department that if you put him in a position of power and if he is seen as being anointed by Washington in some way, that he will just be a puppet government and that he really won't have legitimacy among the Iraqi people.
When you talk about legitimacy among the Iraqi people, the problem of getting it might be that he hasn't lived in Iraq since the late 1950s, so he's not really connected to the people there and hasn't been living in the country for decades.
That's right, and I think because of that, we just have no idea how he will be received. He was one of the people advising the Defense Department in the lead-up to the war, and in part of his advice to the Defense Department made it seem as though we, the coalition forces, would be welcomed with open arms when we started going into the country. So I think there is some reason to be concerned about putting too much stock in what he says will happen on the ground in Iraq. He claims to have a lot of supporters on the ground in Iraq, but it is not at all clear that he does, and I think it's just unfair at this point to assume one way or the other. I think it is fair in part to assume that he will be at least seen with questionable legitimacy in the eyes of Iraqis because he has not lived through the Saddam Hussein regime and he has been on the outside the entire time. But because no one has really been in the country for a very long time, it is quite possible that the other might happen and that he would be welcome just by virtue of being an Iraqi. And so I think it's a little bit too early to tell what his reception will be, although I do have to put some stock in the opinion of experts on the matter that he has at best questionable legitimacy inside the country.
Let's look at another controversy surrounding the United States now, and that is who gets the contracts for rebuilding Iraq. What is the process the United States is using now to make that decision?
At the moment, they have only put out for bids a few very major contracts, and it's been under an expedited process, and the contracts have only been offered to a few companies, a few major U.S. companies. So for now, we are seeing a very particular process, and I think that was it was done that way because they wanted to find, the Bush administration wanted to find a few companies who would be ready to go in as soon as the situation from a security standpoint was safe in Iraq for these companies to go in and start doing reconstruction projects. As you mentioned, this is a controversial issue. The fact that these contracts have been offered only to U.S. companies has caused considerable consternation in countries throughout the world, including in Britain and Australia, the countries that are with us in the coalition, but also, of course, in France and Germany and other countries where companies would really like to see access to these lucrative reconstruction contracts.
Now, a controversy within who gets the contracts is the role of Halliburton, the oil service company that was headed by Vice President Cheney before Cheney joined the Bush administration. Kellogg Brown and Root, a subsidiary of Halliburton, has already gotten contracts to rebuild oil wells. I understand that Halliburton is actually out of the running for contracts now, for new contracts. What's the status of that?
Well, they have said that they are out of the running for the other rebuilding contracts, at least as the prime contractor, although it has also been stated that they will be seeking to perform subcontracts under the major contracts. So I think they will presumably be involved in some way in these major contracts. Whether they took themselves out of the running or somebody took them, you know, they were just taken out of the running as part of the bidding process, it's a little bit unclear. But it has been stated that they're out of the running for the major $600 million AID contract at this point anyway. They have, as you mentioned, gotten this contract to fight oil well fires and perform emergency repairs on Iraq's oil fields. I think it's safe to assume that Halliburton would like to have a role in Iraq because there will be very lucrative contracts both on the rebuilding front and looking forward oil development contracts. But for now, they are not in the running for this major USAID contract.
Bathsheba Crocker co-directs the Post-Conflict Reconstruction Project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. She'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Scorched Earth, a novel of suspense by David L. Robbins, author of War of the Rats. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more on rebuilding Iraq with Bathsheba Crocker. Also, we remember Cecile de Bruinhoff, who died Sunday at the age of 99. She created the bedtime story that inspired the Babar the Elephant series. We'll hear from her son, who wrote and illustrated most of the Babar books. And Milo Miles considers two soul singers, a newcomer and a veteran. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Bathsheba Crocker, co-director of the Post-Conflict Reconstruction Project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. She's one of the authors of the report A Wiser Peace, which proposes a strategy for post-conflict Iraq. The report is a collaboration between the Center and the Association of the United States Army. In Iraq, we're going to have to help create a new civil society. A lot of the civil society under Saddam Hussein was corrupted. The police were his police that terrorized the population. The civil structure was comprised of his extended family and his cronies. How much of that is going to stay in place? Will everybody who is connected to Saddam Hussein and his regime be replaced by new people? Will some of them, do you think, be allowed to keep their positions in the police or in the bureaucracy, in the judicial system?
I think we will see a good deal of the civil servant and the bureaucracy retained, but that at the higher levels, we will see people vetted and moved out of their positions. So although there are many, many, many card-carrying members of the Ba'ath Party throughout Iraq, I think some people did that just as a matter of expediency or to keep their families safe, and that the folks that we have to be really concerned about are those at the very top of all of the government institutions, whether it's the police or the central government ministries, or the military or the security apparatus. It is assumed that certain Iraqi ministries, for example, the Ministry of Information, which, as we are even seeing in the past few days, has just been used as a tool of propaganda by the government, will probably have to be scrapped and completely reconstituted. And the same could be said about certain other institutions, such as the security and intelligence apparatus. But when talking about the police, for example, it is assumed that the higher levels of the police will have to be moved out, and that perhaps in the interim they would be replaced by international civil policemen in an advisory and supervisory capacity. But that at the lower levels, at the sort of bureaucratic level, that what you have is probably a fairly well-trained police force that could be called upon to continue to do some sort of regular law enforcement and policing functions. And the same could be said of the civil servant class throughout the Iraqi government ministries. I think the assumption is that you will be able to retain a lot of what already exists. And in fact, that is part of the Bush administration's plan, as far as I understand it. They intend to continue paying around 2 million Iraqi civil servants to continue doing their jobs after Saddam falls.
Do you think the U.S. military will be comfortable with the idea of police who served under Saddam Hussein still serving as police with weapons?
That's a very good question. I'm not sure how heavily armed Iraq's police force is. The same question needs to be addressed with respect to Iraq's national army. Generally, when you talk about what to do with an army after a conflict like this, you have to think in terms of disarmament and demobilization and reintegration of the armed forces. We're going to have to address that in Iraq. The question of the police, I think at the moment it's a little bit difficult to tell. The Bush administration has not talked a lot about its plans for the Iraqi police force. But the estimates of the police force are that it's between 35,000 and 58,000 people. Again, you might assume that the top 10% or so of that will have to be moved out of their jobs because they will be sort of senior Ba'ath Party officials. But it may be that at the lower level, as far as we understand, at the lower level, the police have been sort of just doing very basic law enforcement functions. The things that we've heard about in terms of human rights abuses and the more atrocious actions of the Saddam Hussein regime, I think, have been carried out more by his security apparatus, which are not the regular police force, but totally separate troops.
President Bush says that the oil in Iraq belongs to the Iraqi people and it will be used to help and support the Iraqi people. The president also plans on using revenues from oil to pay for the rebuilding of Iraq. Will there be enough oil revenue to fund the very expensive process of rebuilding Iraq?
I don't think so, at least not in the most immediate term. Although Iraq has considerable oil reserves, second in the world only to Saudi Arabia, as far as we understand. There's not enough oil money to go around to pay for all the needs in that country. At the moment, at current production levels, Iraq is earning about $16 billion a year in oil revenue. That's obviously an enormous amount of money. But also, currently, about 70% of that revenue is going to humanitarian needs under the Oil for Food program. We don't know what the future of the Oil for Food program will be, if anything. But it is safe to assume that the humanitarian needs in Iraq will continue for at least some period of time. And unless we see humanitarian needs being made up completely from outside donations, I think some of the oil revenue will continue to be used for humanitarian needs. Some of the oil revenue is also currently being used to pay for claims related to the previous Gulf War, reparations claims. Again, it may be that there is a decision made that oil money should no longer be used to pay back those claims. But between humanitarian needs and the claims at this time, there is about 3% of Iraq's oil revenues left over to pay for any other needs, which doesn't get you very far when you're talking about a possible reconstruction bill of between $20 to $25 billion in the first year, which is what most estimates assume we'll need. I think it's also important to factor into other points. One is that the oil infrastructure itself in Iraq needs a considerable amount of investment to get it back up to pre-Gulf War production levels. Estimates for that range in the tens of billions of dollars. And then also that there are a lot of Iraq has a huge amount of financial obligations at the moment, both the reparations claims that I mentioned earlier, but then also bilateral debt. So there will be a lot of competing claims on this money between humanitarian needs, reconstruction needs, paying for basic sort of government ministries in Iraq, the continuing function of the government ministries, possibly paying back claims, possibly paying back debts, and then the investment that is needed in the oil infrastructure itself, and there just won't be enough money to go around. I think as we look down a few years out, if we've seen some investment in the oil infrastructure and as humanitarian needs taper off, more and more of that money will become available for reconstruction needs. But in the immediate term, I just don't think it's reasonable to assume that all of that money can be used to fund the reconstruction effort.
Does the Bush administration have a plan to make up that financial gap if, in fact, the Iraqi oil revenues aren't big enough to cover the bills for reconstructing Iraq?
Well, the Bush administration has requested some money for reconstruction efforts in the supplemental budget request that President Bush submitted a few weeks ago. So at the moment, I think we'll see $2.5 billion from the Congress for immediate reconstruction needs. There is also about $1.7 billion in Iraqi frozen assets in the United States that the U.S. government has seized, again, to pay for reconstruction needs. But this is just a drop in the bucket, which the Bush administration has also acknowledged. Going out, I think we will see future requests for more funds from the Congress, but I don't think that there's an expectation that the U.S. taxpayer is going to foot this entire bill. So again, I think what we'll have to see, as we've seen in recent other post-conflict situations like Afghanistan and Kosovo, is real help from our friends and allies and from the major international donors to help make up some of these costs. Again, I think it's reasonable to assume that the oil money can be used in part for the reconstruction needs, but that we will need to see some sort of a donors conference and pledging of funds from other countries in addition to whatever we see in the way of U.S. dollars appropriated by the Congress for this effort. I think the initial appropriation will be enough to cover sort of the immediate contract that the Bush administration is talking about. But when you're talking about an overall bill of around $100 billion, I think it's not reasonable to assume the U.S. is going to make up that entire bill. And this is, again, just gets back to the importance of the diplomacy. Because many of the European countries have said they only want to participate if there's a UN mandate for the post-war phase, it makes it that much more important that we mend our relations with our friends and allies and come to some agreement at the UN about a possible UN role in the post-war phase.
We've been talking about rebuilding Iraq and trying to create a democracy within the post-Saddam Iraq. What's at stake now for the United States as it tries to accomplish this, as it tries to oversee the creation of a democracy?
Well, I think there's a lot at stake. This is obviously a very critical region for U.S. interests, in addition to the possible sort of oil politics that I don't really understand all that much. We obviously have the Israel-Palestinian issue, which is a continuing and very serious one and seen as quite closely linked to what happens in Iraq. President Bush has made a lot of very significant promises about what could happen in Iraq in the future and what could happen and what that might mean for the region. I think it is in longer-term U.S. interest to see a gradual process of democratization throughout the region, and that is certainly one of the things that that the Bush administration seems to be expecting might happen if we are successful in creating a democracy in Iraq. I think it's also will be the future of Iraq also will be very important from the perspective of the level of anti-Americanism that we've seen throughout the world, and particularly throughout the Muslim world. We have made a lot of very serious promises to the Iraqi people, and I think it will be very important for us to follow through on those promises. The worst thing that we could do, it seems to me, is go into this country without the stamp of the United Nations, without the international approval for this war effort, overthrow a government in the Arab world, and then not follow through with the kind of commitment that we will need to show in order to really bring democracy to Iraq and then possibly to the region.
Bathsheba Crocker co-directs the Post-Conflict Reconstruction Project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Coming up, we remember Cecile Dobrunov, creator of Babar the Elephant. This is Fresh Air. The creator of Babar the Elephant, Cecile Dobrunov, died Monday in Paris at the age of 99. Babar, the benevolent elephant king, was the main character in one of the most popular series of children's books of the 20th century. Cecile Dobrunov created Babar for a bedtime story that she told her children in 1930. The following year, her husband, the illustrator Jean Dobrunov, began a series of Babar books. After his death in 1937, his son, Laurent Dobrunov, continued the series. He has written and illustrated more than 40 Babar books. I spoke with Laurent Dobrunov in 1990 and asked if he remembered his mother telling him the story of Babar.
I don't remember her telling the story to my brother and I. It's one of those memories, you know, that you don't remember yourself, but you have been talked about by your friends or your parents. And my father at that time was not already a writer of children's books. He was a painter. And when we told him about these stories that my mother had told us, we were so excited that he wanted to make a book for us about it. That's what he did. And that was the birth of Babar.
Maurice Sendak, the children's book writer and illustrator, wrote the introduction for an anthology of six Babar stories, three of them written by your father, three of them written by you. And in the introduction, he talked about his reaction to the first Babar story, in which Babar's mother is shot by a hunter, and the baby Babar is off on his own. Mm-hmm. And Sendak said that the ease and remarkable calm in which Dobrunov blighted the life of his baby elephant numbed me. Tell me what your reaction was when Maurice Sendak told you that he was just very very upset, by the way, that Babar's mother was shot.
I was a little bit amused, because this is a reaction that I hear very often, of course. There is something awful to have the mother shot on the second page of a children's book. But, and I would point out that this idea was my mother's, not my father. And this is the only death in the book, except that the old king is dying too in the same book. And that was my mother's idea again. I think Maurice, who is a good friend of mine, put too much, he emphasized too much the aspect of the death of the mother. I think it's simpler than that. The writer, the person telling the story, wanted the hero, Baba, to be free, I mean, to struggle with the world all by himself and to get himself in control of his own life. That's why the link with his mother was broken. And Baba, in fact, the characteristic of this character is that it is always in control of any situation.
So it becomes a story about growing up, about separating from your parents.
Exactly.
And finding your own self.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Now, I had to tell you about, you probably know about this, I'm sure you must, but there's another interpretation of the Babar stories that I want to ask you about. Ariel Dorfman, who's a Chilean writer, has a book called The Empire's Old Clothes, What the Lone Ranger, Babar, and Other Innocent Heroes Do to Our Minds. And it's an analysis of Walt Disney and Babar and the Lone Ranger and how they feed into certain kind of capitalist and colonialist fantasies. And he describes the Babar stories as an idealized colonial history. He writes, "History is sweetened up. The way in which Europe handled the natives in Africa is justified. Sure, there was some plundering in Africa, but just look at how happy the elephants are now." How do you react to that kind of analysis of the Babar stories?
Well, I know the theory of Ariel Dorfman, and I think there is a lot of truth in that theory. What irritates me is the lack of humor, the total lack of humor of Dorfman about that. I mean that it is true that we can find some kind of a colonialist cliché in the story of Baba, this little elephant coming from the jungle and meeting civilization and coming back, bringing civilization to his pal. Of course, but that was the way people thought at that time. So it is not surprising that there is some kind of reflection of this philosophy in my first father book. But it's wrong to say that it's an imperialist book and this is giving bad ideas to kids, because the children don't read and look at books that way. They just enjoy them.
Do you feel that that there was a certain colonialism that you moved away from in your own books?
In my own book, I got another problem once. In, I think it was my second book, I again was influenced by some stereotype of the 30s. I wanted to picture some black African people, and I did it in the way that they were presented by artists in the 30s, that is, with enormous red lips and things like that, and feathers, you know, as African natives, caricatured as they were in the 30s. And this book was published in France. And it was also published in America. And once an editor at Random House, who was not a children editor, but an editor of a novel, saw the book. She was black, and she was shocked. And guess who it was? It was Toni Morrison.
Oh, really?
And at that time, I was absolutely embarrassed, because I knew she was perfectly right and was sort of ashamed of having pictured the black in such a stereotype fashion. And we dropped this book. The book was not printed anymore.
Laurent de Brunhoff recorded in 1990. He's written and illustrated more than 40 Babar books. His mother, Cécile de Brunhoff, who created the character of Babar, died Monday at the age of 99. Coming up, music critic Marlo Miles on a veteran soul singer and a newcomer. This is Fresh Air. Two recent soul albums have caught the attention of our music critic Milo Miles. The Colored Section is by newcomer Donnie, and A Woman Like Me is by veteran Betty LaVette, who's been absent from the American music scene for years.
In the late 60s and early 70s, soul music was right in the moment. It was all about passion, love and happiness, as Al Green put it, and about newfound pride, respect, as Otis Redding said. Now that soul is venerable and on the margins of music, it's still about those things, but with a new twist. The finest soul records in the last year are about history, American history in the case of Donnie's The Colored Section, and personal history in the case of Betty LaVette's A Woman Like Me. Donnie comes out of the same neo-soul scene in Atlanta that produced India Arie, and like hers, his style might be called literate retro. No question his voice and music borrow heavily from prime period Stevie Wonder, sometimes too heavily. But fortunately, his lyrics draw on the Stevie of Living for the City, not I Just Called to Say I Love You. There's a certain bourgeois high-mindedness about Donnie's approach to alienation, love, and hardship, but he has a lighter touch than many. Instead of floating above materialism and middle-class privilege, Donnie prefers to skewer it. Although some of his love songs belong in the colorless section, Donnie is exciting in part because he's bringing a sense of history into the future. On the other hand, Betty LaVette's A Woman Like Me gains heft because it could only be made by a performer with a past. Her first release was her most successful. She was a teenager in 1962 when she cut My Man, He's a Lovin' Man, a top 10 R&B hit and as saucy as anything Tina Turner ever did.
My man. Then there were decades of fizzles and false starts for Levette. Strong singles with no follow-ups. Albums that weren't released. She was even a 70s Broadway star in Bubbling Brown Sugar, but there was no real room for her at the disco. Levette's first American album in 20 years, however, is the finest comeback set in recent memory. Aside from Levette herself, the key figure is producer Dennis Walker, who made Robert Cray's albums into modern blues masterpieces and wrote all but two of the songs on A Woman Like Me.
Half before my breakfast, shot of whiskey on the side.
Walker also knows how to get a soul sound as close to timeless as possible. Basic, but not a throwback. Nothing trendy, but no nostalgia. Levette's voice now has grit around the edges, all the better for reflecting on a life's worth of struggles and strains. The song sequence of A Woman Like Me suggests Willie Nelson's classic Phases and Stages, told from a female perspective. It's either a big breakup or scenes from a half dozen of them. There's a couple weather metaphors, temptation that won't stop, neglect that won't end, and Betty Levette's right with you through all of it, first getting hurt, then getting angry, and finally getting even. Because, after all, living well is the best revenge on history. And right now, for both Donnie and Betty, people should be ready to listen.
Milo Miles lives in Cambridge. He reviewed The Colored Section by Donnie and A Woman Like Me by Betty Levette.
Tell him time and time again, just wasn't gonna be his fool. Patience is growing thin. I made it very clear that a cheater always pays, but nothing I told that man make him change his ways. So hard for a woman to give up on a man.
Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross.
When a woman's had enough,
Major your funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Toms of Maine, maker of natural care products and creator of Rivers Awareness Program to preserve the nation's waterways. Information at participating stores or tomsofmaine.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, John Travolta talks about his life and his movies. He's starring in the new military mystery, Basic. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.